south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander...
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started. All right, now, here's something that needs to be said, but nobody's saying it. You got all these refugee rights groups and people out in the desert giving food and water to illegal aliens that have slipped through to the States. And believe it or not, if you were down here watching these caravans of people organizing themselves, you have to wonder, who's really doing the organizing? They don't have some kind of Vulcan mind meld going and 2,000 of them show up 10 miles from the border and say, all right, let's begin the march. I'm telling you, there are organized groups, Soros-funded types, down here setting up NGOs, making all these new and stronger caravans possible. It's so true. I've been down here almost 28 years now, and I'll tell you, I've never seen anything like this happen before. Sure, people have always been slipping in and out of the U.S. illegally, but never, I mean never, in organized caravans like this. You have to realize one thing about people trying to get across. They've got nothing. They haven't got a pot to pee in. They've got no diplomas, education, careers, nothing that could get them ahead in this world in a legitimate way. They're at the low end of the economic, IQ, and creativity scale. Obviously, if they were way above average, they'd have figured out how to make a living and stay safe in their own countries. Hey, and if you think that's a stretch or I'm just being plain old racist, you ought to read up on the most common traits of successful men and women. Now, you may have heard or read this before. It's a truism, and the experiment's been tried over and over again. If you take a successful, smart, creative man or woman, you drop them into any country with just $100 and the clothes on their backs, and even if they don't know the language, if you come back a couple months later to check them out, you'll find that most of them have got something going for themselves once again. Which brings us back to the original question. Why do all these dirt poor, uneducated people with nothing left to lose suddenly form themselves into these giant organized caravans? I mean, look, it takes a leader or two and great organizational skills to drive a caravan a couple of thousand miles through cities and countrysides, highs and lows, rivers and valleys, etc. There's a lot of logistics involved, not to mention it takes dough. And of course, that's one thing illegal migrants don't have is dough, which is why they're heading to the States. You know, el sueño americano, the American dream, streets paved with gold, the promised land and all that. Just think about the basics, the necessities, the food, the water, the shelter, the porta potties, at least, well, for the women, because, you know, for most Latin males anyway, the world is their porta potty. Oh, and get this, I've seen these guys up close, and isn't it funny that a lot of them have better footwear than I have? Doesn't that seem rather odd? All right, on that note, I want to read you this. An article that just came out this morning, and man, it's like deja vu all over again. Though it's not happening here, it's happening in South America. And after I read this, then, all you bleeding hearts out there, tell me about the big, bad United States as it tries to hold back all the poor, wretched masses who are just trying to get a leg up in the world. All right, here we go. And the title of this article is, Refugee Rights Groups Blast New Government Requirement for Venezuelans Entering Ecuador. This is from the newspaper El Telegrafo, the Telegraph, actually translated into English. How about that? It starts out, refugee rights representatives are claiming that a new requirement that Venezuelans entering Ecuador must show proof that they have no criminal record is unfair and could amount to a death sentence for people trying to escape the Venezuelan regime. All right, let's stop and analyze that a bit. Do you think it's unfair that a government would require immigrants to prove that they're not criminals before permitting them to settle in their country? Man, does that touch a nerve, huh? Especially since if any gringo wants to get his residency in a Latin country, he has to get an apostille police or FBI report. And it's got to be squeaky clean or your application gets rejected. Anyway, the article goes on to say, Daniel Regalado, spokesman for a Venezuelan refugee organization. Yep, they got those too. He says the rule is grossly unjust since the document Ecuador is requiring, that would be a clean police report, is impossible to obtain for most Venezuelans. Then it says, like most other functions in the Venezuelan government, the website that accepts requests for the police report document is not working now. And even when it does, he says, it's only processing around 60 applications a month. So then why is this such a big issue now? Well, before this week, Venezuelans were allowed to come into Ecuador without such a document. And Ecuadorian Vice President Otto Sanzenholzer, say what? Sanzenholzer? Man, that sounds 100% German. How'd he get to be vice president of a Latin country? Anyway, Otto Sanzenholzer announced Monday that all Venezuelans entering Ecuador must now present an apostille certificate from the Venezuelan government showing that said person has not been arrested or ever been held on criminal charges, which on the surface of it sounds completely illogical. But get this, the new requirement follows the Saturday night murder of a pregnant Ecuadorian woman in Ibarra. Her lights were put out by her Venezuelan boyfriend. Meanwhile, President Lenin Moreno says that Ecuador was now taking several extreme measures to protect itself against foreign criminals, including the establishment of a special police unit to monitor the habits of Venezuelans once they enter the country. Now, isn't that ironic? You got everyone up in the States so worried about Trump and the Border Control and ICE threatening to crack the whip on illegal immigrants. Meanwhile, in Ecuador, you got President Lenin Moreno and his vice president, who've always been very socialist-leaning, seriously cracking the whip, not just threatening to do it. But of course, you don't read about that in the first world press, only the big bad USA monster cracking down on those poor, cold, shivering unfortunates who many say deserve asylum in the grand old US of A. But I digress as usual. Anyway, then the article goes on to say, human rights groups and legal organizations criticize President Moreno's comments following the murder, calling them xenophobic and a violation of international human rights, saying the new police report requirement slams the doors in the face of Venezuelans fleeing poverty and oppression. Where have we heard that before? Every night on the 6 o'clock news, maybe? Anyway, Regalado says, quote, with this policy, Ecuador is turning its back on its publicly stated policy of offering anyone from any country refuge from oppression. Then it says, other South American refugee rights advocates claim that the new policy will not stop criminals at all. Do you think that criminals will go through the process of getting those documents? Of course not, says Carmen Gomez, a university professor and immigration expert in Ecuador. Then there's a note of caution. It says, following Vice President Steinenholzer's announcement of that clean police report requirement. Wait a minute. There he is again, Vice President Steinenholzer. How'd he get that job? Don't worry, we'll talk about that later. Anyway, it says, the president's secretary, Ron Sebastian Roldan, suggests that Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro is knowingly exporting criminals out of the country, saying that he is emptying prison cells, he said, and allowing dangerous criminals to pass through Ecuador's borders, saying now is the time for Ecuador to protect itself from such activities. All right, there you have it, fresh off the presses. Talk about deja vu. Man, are you hearing this? And you thought the U.S. had immigration and border control problems. No, it's interesting to see how other so-called democratic countries handle it, especially when known criminals are penetrating their borders. Now, here's the part that really differs from the problem the U.S. has and why it's even stranger than it sounds. Think about the type of people they're doing it to and who it's affecting the most. They're targeting people who share the same culture and speak the very same language and, in most cases, they'll admit, are more educated than their own population. So, in effect, the Ecuadorian government is turning away a higher class of people than its own citizens. In other words, they've got a reverse brain drain going, and they want to put a halt to it. Meanwhile, up in the States, you've got shit for brains politicians like Governor Jerry Brown of California creating sanctuary cities, in fact, a sanctuary state, for poor, uneducated people from a different culture who don't even speak English. I wonder, what are your thoughts on that? Well, here's mine. I think Jerry Brown and all his Hollywood liberal loudmouth friends should let a few of those poor indigent families move into their guest houses, don't you think? Meanwhile, Ecuadorians are having none of that, even with people who are culturally and educationally superior and speak the same language. What do you make of that? Oh, and speaking of Ecuador, here's a question I get a lot. Not just about Ecuador, El Salvador, Belize, and Panama too. You know what they've all got in common? They used the U.S. dollar as their currency. Yep, they all had their own funny money at one time, but they switched over just in the last 10 or 20 years. And people occasionally ask me, how could that be? How can a country give up its own currency? A currency that's been around for, in some cases, 100 years or so. Money with their own favorite corrupt genocidal dictators on it. Not to mention, they're always printed in sizes and colors that are a lot prettier than the paper U.S. dead presidents are printed on. Now, you'd think a country's own funny money is part of their sovereignty, part of their patrimony, national identity, so to speak. So why would they give that up? And then you get the question, doesn't having a U.S. dollar currency make them kind of U.S. puppets in a way? Well, of course, and all Latin government officials are on the take. And who shovels out most of that dough to those idiots? Well, your own idiot uncle, Sam. And of course, most of you listeners to this program know the U.S. dollar is nothing but its own kind of funny money. It itself is a rapidly depreciating currency when you consider that in 1913, when that wretched organization called the Federal Reserve was born, 3 cents back then would buy what a dollar buys today. So the dirty little secret is that the U.S. dollar's lost 97% of its purchasing power in 100 years. But compared to Latin currencies, it seems like the Rock of Gibraltar, the gold standard. So, as it turns out, in the last 10 or 20 years or so, when Latin countries have had hyperinflation, many of them switched to the U.S. dollar. As in the case of Belize, Panama, Ecuador, and El Salvador. In fact, it was on January 9th, 2000, just 19 years ago, President Jamil Mulhaled announced that Ecuador would end the use of their national currency, the Sucre, which at the time suffered Latin America's highest rate of inflation. However, if you look back on 1999, when Ecuador's inflation numbers topped 100% a year, that seems absolutely tame, even rock-solid stable compared to Venezuela's inflation rates of thousands of percent a year. Anyway, back in Ecuador, in 1999, the national economy had contracted 7.5% in 1 year, topped 100% inflation, and President Mahud hoped switching to the U.S. dollar would attract investment and stabilize the economy. Well, he wasn't around to see what would happen when they dollarized. He was kicked out of office on January 21st by the National Congress and replaced by his vice president, Gustavo Noboa. In fact, back then, the country was so pissed off that he would sell the country down the river to the Americans by switching to the U.S. dollar, that his popularity dropped from 70 to 6%. So they booted him and he left the country. Then, as you might expect, there was chaos in the financial markets. The conversion to the dollar was very controversial and bank accounts were frozen. And the Sucre, their old funny money, was drastically devalued just prior to the changeover to dollars, leaving most Ecuadorians busted, the majority with no savings at all. And for those of you who knew that already, I'll bet you didn't know that the Guayaquil newspaper, El Universal, reported more than 200 suicides by people who suffered massive financial losses. Now compare that with the so-called jumpers of the Great Depression in 1929. It got a lot of press, but did you know there were only around 100 people who attempted or committed suicide due to huge financial losses? It sounds hard to believe, but the Ecuadorian economy took a bigger beating than Wall Street did in 29. Not only that, more than 20 Ecuadorian banks went out of business between 1999 and 2000. Oh, and here's something else you didn't know. Many on the board of directors of those 20 failed banks fled the country with the dough, most of them settling in guess where? My jammy. Furnishing yet more proof that nice guys finish last, and who says crime doesn't pay? Oh, and by the way, every time I happen to be in one of those dollarized Latin countries, I ask a porter, a taxi driver, or some local who's sitting next to me in a coffee shop what he thinks about the fact that they don't have a national currency, and almost to a person, they don't like being dollarized. They complain about it. They all say the dollar makes things more expensive, and it never really helped the common man. All right, enough said about that, but just one more thing about Ecuador and Latin America in general. You know, another question I always get is, how safe is it to live in Latin America? And I always say, it's all about the neighborhood. Just like up in the States or in any country, there are lots of crap neighborhoods and lots of very good ones and lots of, okay ones in the daytime, but not so okay to walk alone at night. But as a general rule, it's much safer to live in a small town, a town under 50,000. Why? Well, for one, a lot of the bad boys and troublemakers get the hell out of a small town and move to a big city because there's more action there. And a lot of them get the hell out because of what I'm reporting on now that comes from a recent article. This one entitled, Ecuador Lynching Mob is Halted. Now, you've heard me say many times that in small town Latin America, just like up in the States, everyone knows everybody. And when a bad boy or boys commits one too many petty crimes, the public goes into action because they can't depend on the three or four lard-ass cops in town who are most likely sleeping off a hangover at their version of the local donut shop. That would be the tortilla stand. Anyway, this article says, suspect rescued. One of two delinquents caught robbing parked cars in El Valle was almost burned to death by neighbors. The neighbors being tired of a spate of car robberies. It says the two robbers fled in a car without plates and were chased by owners of the vandalized cars. When the thieves stopped, they were surrounded by over 100 neighbors armed with sticks, rocks, ropes, and gasoline. One thief was later apprehended by the police. However, two of the policemen were injured in the scuffle. Hey, you gotta love small-town Latin America, huh? You could say it's like the Wild West, but man, the Wild West had its heroes too. Bat Masterson, Wild Bill Hickok, Doc Holliday, you know the names, and a lot of those towns were much safer than Cleveland. Meanwhile, we've got some more bad news coming out of Mexico. How about this article, and I'll translate this, titled, Oil Pipeline Theft by Cartels is on the Increase in Big Business in Mexico. And I'll paraphrase this and cut out the boring parts as usual. It starts out, oil thieves stole more than 600 million gallons of fuel from Mexico's Pemex refineries in 2016, representing at least $1.5 billion in losses to the state-owned company. In 2017, incidents of oil theft recorded by Pemex reached record highs, jumping to 9,509 reported oil theft incidents. According to various reports, including one in U.S. magazine Rolling Stone, state that Mexico's oil and gas reserves represent a store of wealth to narcos much greater than cocaine or marijuana ever could. Thus, as marijuana and marijuana products become more and more legalized throughout the world, narco groups are adapting and changing their focus to stealing oil. But it's not only organized crime and narcos, it's the corruption within the government and the fact that the Mexican government owns and operates the oil business that makes the industry so vulnerable. Since Mexico has 9,000 kilometers, that's around 7,000 miles of pipelines, that really need to be monitored 24 hours a day to prevent pilferage, it's an impossible task, say oil pipeline engineers. There are not enough soldiers, policemen, or sailors to monitor a tenth of it. But here's what you didn't know. Mexico's oil theft industry is booming and has been a staple of organized crime in the country for years. In fact, oil thieving is so common, it's considered a profession, and they're known as huachicoleros. Huachicoleros. Man, can you imagine sitting in the lobby of the car mechanic, making small talk with the guy next to you? You say, hey, I'm Johnny, retired engineer, living here in Latin America. Now, what do you do? He says, who, me? I'm a huachicolero. And you don't skip a beat. You give him a fist bump and say, cool, how's business? This your day off? Anyway, you know, it used to be small-time groups with an insider or two that would rip off the oil company here and there. And oddly enough, it just kept going on. No one seemed to care because it was a government enterprise. Because, man, I'll tell you, when a private company owns resources like that, they make sure there's very little theft. And when they catch someone, they make him pay. But, you know, whatever the government does, it does poorly. Corruption is rampant and people just don't give a shit. For example, examples are hard to find. Just the other day, I was reading about the welfare benefit system in California. Did you know that California has 70 different welfare programs you can get on? But I digress as usual. Where are we? Oh, yeah. So what about the massive increase in oil thefts? Well, Analysts are saying it's not just oil thieves. It's far more complicated than that. They're saying it wouldn't be possible without the complicity of engineers and workers at Pemex's refineries. The fact is, you need guys on the inside to pull off the kind of thieving that's been going on lately. That means just like any cancerous government organization, Pemex, Mexico's nationalized oil company, has employees who are sharing maps of the pipelines as well as information as to the best ways of piercing them. Like, for example, the weakest points, the most isolated points, and when skeleton crews are in charge because men are on vacation. And get this, the former head of security at Pemex, and his name is Leon Trawitz, is under investigation for his role in helping facilitate oil theft, according to a recent article in the publication El Universal. Are you getting this? The head of security of the oil company, the guy in charge of eliminating theft, at least keeping it to a minimum, is a corrupt SOB himself. Oh, and this is good. According to one highly placed Echo Colero, certain Pemex officials notify thieves of the exact time that oil will be pumped through the pipelines, in addition, providing them with the equipment needed to extract that oil safely. In fact, this particular highly placed oil stealing informer says that it involves public prosecutors, municipal authorities, state secretaries, and it goes as far up as you can imagine. With everyone getting a slice, everyone getting paid off. To make matters worse, Pemex is facing serious fuel production issues, with Pemex's six main oil refineries operating at just 40% of their capacity and producing the lowest amount and volume of oil registered in the last 25 years. Meanwhile, the disaster news story of the week out of Latin America is Taluchelapan, Mexico, where a gasoline pipeline blast killed at least 79 people. You've probably seen a drip and a drab of that story in the first world media, because it's kind of close to home. But here's what you didn't know about that story. It ties in with fuel theft. It turns out investigators have found that fuel thieves were the ones that punctured the Tuxpan pipeline a few miles from one of Mexico's main refineries on Friday. And get this, and man, don't you wish someone would have got this on video. Up to 800 people flocked to fill their plastic containers from the 25-foot pure gasoline geyser that ensued after the pipeline was punctured. Yeah, you can bet that was real safe. Anyway, a couple hours later, it erupted in flames, resulting in a huge explosion. So as it turns out, nearly all the people who were killed had nothing to do with puncturing the pipeline. They just saw that it was spewing gas and they went to go steal some. Now here's something else people don't know. When a private company like BP Oil, for example, owns a pipeline, they have detectors up and down the thing, and when they detect a slight pressure drop, meaning there's a leak or someone stealing fuel, they immediately close the valve to stop the flow to minimize the leak, and the pressure drops to zero. With private companies, that's virtually immediate. But again, because Pemex is a government-owned and run operation, the pressure and the flow persisted for at least two more hours after the pipe was ruptured. Now, investigators said that even if the valve were closed immediately, there still would have been around 10,000 barrels of high-octane gas in that section of the pipeline between the Tula refinery and the local village. However, with no pressure in the pipeline, it would have been very difficult to steal efficiently. Investigators say part of the blame goes to the government, and part of the blame goes to the people at the ruptured pipeline who knew it was dangerous. And this has got to be the absolute craziest part of this whole fiasco. It says the pipeline had been out of service since late December, while the government tried to secure it from gangs of fuel thieves who had tapped it 10 different times in a period of just a few months. Even crazier, since the pipeline was reopened on January 16th, just a week or so ago, as this broadcast goes out, in just the 4 days following the pipeline's reopening on January 16th, it was tapped again four different times. In other words, fuel thieves hit it four times in 4 days. Yeah. So you expat gonna-bes and wannabes, you still thinking about moving down Mexico way? You know, I'm not exactly sure, but I think that's reason 4,264 why I'm speaking for myself, would never want to live in Mexico. Hey, but you know, you might like the thrill, the adventure, and the danger of it all. Some people absolutely thrive on that. And now, from the How to Piss Off a Gringo department, I have to tell you, it's no fun for an expat to walk into a U.S. consulate or embassy in any part of the world. I've been to quite a few U.S. embassies, not because I wanted to share milk and cookies with them or say hi to everyone, but because I absolutely had to, whether renewing a passport, getting pages added, getting a certified copy, whatever. And I have to tell you, every time I visit one of those places, I get more and more pissed off at my own frickin' government. It's just a monstrously malignant, multi-tentacled abortion. Don't believe me? Just take the U.S. Embassy in Guatemala. For one thing, it takes up an entire city block. It's got massive security. It's got 4 floors. That's 4 stories. But guess what? The average U.S. citizen, like you or me, no matter what services you're there for, will never, ever get to see what's on the 2nd, 3rd, or 4th floor. Those are off-limits to civilians. So what in the hell are they doing with 3 extra floors? Surveillance and alphabet agency stuff, of course. And little Guatemala, with 16 million people on the world stage, is insignificant. But now, surprise, surprise, there's a huge article in the biggest Guatemalan newspaper, in Spanish, of course, called the Prensa Libre, with a 2-page photo spread of the new, vastly bigger U.S. embassy they're building in Guatemala now. Now, the old one was 1 city block. The new one, get this, on 9.5 acres. 9.5 acres! Oh, and this article is such a nice PR suck-up to the U.S. It says it will be green, energy efficient, and eco-friendly, with solar panels generating 10% of its electricity. Ha ha, 10%. What a bunch of morons. With all the sun in Guatemala, only 10%? Oh, and it says in the parking lot, there will be charge stations for electric cars. Oh, that's so wonderful, considering that there isn't a single electric frickin' car in all of Guatemala. What a kiss-ass, suck-up, puff piece this is. But it's what they're not telling you. It's not just another multi-billion dollar monument to the deep, dark underbelly of the Big Brother surveillance state. It's a signal to me that moving out of the United States was the best thing I could have ever done. There's no going back to what the U.S. once was. No party or person that can fix it. The cancer in the U.S. government has metastasized to the brain. But go ahead. If you want to waste some time and energy and a little gas exercising your so-called right to vote because you think that's actually going to make a difference, before you do that, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com, and I'll send you a picture of this multi-billion dollar monstrosity on 9.5 acres that you're paying for but no one ever told you about. Meanwhile, there are at least 150 of these monstrosities in capital cities all over the world. Go ahead, shoot me an email and see it for yourself. You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, you can schedule a one-on-one phone call with me. But first, download my free Plan B questionnaire at www.thenewexpat.com. Better yet, if you want to get your Plan B going from right up there in the States, just sign up for my 9-hour Expat Essentials course. Get the perfect Plan B blueprint by going to theexpatfiles.com/academy. Nos vemos!